The information contained in this episode of Life of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs. G'day ladies and gents, Matty Michael here for another episode of Life of Mine, the go-to mining podcast. Now in this episode I chat with Nick Erner, Managing Director at Alkane Resources, ASX ticker ALK. Now thanks to Robbo and the crew at Corporate Storytime again for teeing this yarn up. Now Alkane, they're a very interesting story. They've got their flagship producing asset, Tomingley, which is near Dubbo in New South Wales. So Tomingley pumped out 73,000 ounces of gold last year at a all-in sustaining cost of $1,300 an ounce. But they've also got the Boda Kaiser Exploration Project, which is 35Ks east of Dubbo. And it's about 130Ks north of the massive Newcrest porphyry copper gold operation of Cadia Valley. Now, Boda Kaiser hosts a 15 million ounce gold equivalent resource with lots of ground to further explore, and they're looking to prove up a similar style deposit to Cadia Valley. Now, Nick takes us through a bit about his career, but more so an in-depth yarn about the history of Alkane and where they're heading. Absolutely cracking bloke, and it was a very insightful chat about a gold producer and explorer from my favourite neck of the woods in New South Wales. So let's get into my chat with Nick Erner. Here we go.
Check in the portal.
Copy, shift box.
I get radio check.
Yeah, radio's working fine.
Yeah, copy off personnel.
Yeah, copy, mate.
The chair in the vent bag.
Yeah, stitcher up there. Thanks, mate.
Yeah, right, copy that.
Nick Erner, Alkane, welcome to Life of Mine, mate. First one.
Thanks very much.
It's been very highly anticipated from, I'm just on a absolute corporate story type roadshow at the moment with all the clients. So, and you're the, you'd say the top of the food chain there, you're the highest market cap there.
Yeah, which is hopefully for everyone else, not for long, right?
Yeah, yeah. You'd think you'd do up a t-shirt for you or something, mate. Mate, tell us a bit, before we get into Alkane and get into how long Alkane's been around, tell us a bit, brief bit about yourself, your background, and how long you've been with Alkane for as the top dog.
So I'm actually trained as a chemical engineer at the University of Queensland.
Jeez, you get all varieties in the MD, spicy.
Yeah, graduated out of there in 94, started working in 95. And then like so many people in CEO or managing director or, you know, section head roles, you end up getting a diverse range of experience which exposes you to another area. It might be exposing you to maintenance practices, and then suddenly you're maintaining underground equipment, and then suddenly you're doing underground stuff, and then suddenly you're in a general management role, right? That's sort of the way I ended up there. A big chunk of my career at Olympic Dam when it was WMC and then bought out by BHP. I was there for about a year and a half under BHP, back into coal, and then period of time with Straits Resources in its sort of boom phase in the late 2000s, and then
my first job, underground job at Hillgrove.
Yeah, there you go.
Straits.
Yeah. So I did a stint at Hillgrove as well.
Yeah.
Sadly, I was involved in having to shut that down because it wasn't profitable, right? And then
you might have been the GM when I was You were the GM. Well, I've met you before. Recognize the face. I was there as a grad with Ganser as the underground.
Yeah, with Pete. Yeah. So, really difficult times because, I was hoping to, like you would have been, move there and be there with my family for several years. And then within sort of 6-8 weeks of starting, I thought, wow, this is not going to make the company and therefore shareholders adequate money. And I flew across here and said to the CEO, I think you're gonna have to do this, right?
Which was Milan.
Yeah, Milan. Yeah. And then with them for several years, and then in early 2013, Alkane had just started construction of Tomingley Gold, and it got it approved. And they're looking for someone for an operations background. And a guy I knew, both Ian Chalmers, who was the managing director at the time, he's now a technical director, and I, and put us together, and we hit it off. And my experience both in development and running operations, both open cut and underground, my familiarity, because I've been in coal in New South Wales, my familiarity with the regulatory environment in New South Wales. And then also my familiarity with advanced processing, because at the time we had a rare earths project, which got whole split into in 2020. We split that into Australian Strategic Materials. And so, you know, it was really, you know, a match that worked really well for us. And so I joined Ian as the COO. And then Ian wanted to step back and go into sort of semi-retirement. Brilliant, technical, great leader. And so he became our technical director and I was promoted into the managing director in 2017. And so it doesn't seem like it's been over 5 years now. Yeah.
Time flies, doesn't it?
It does. It does fly. We've done, you know, we've done a lot in that. We've done a lot in that time. As, well,
as MD, a lot of hours go into that 5 years. It's not your typical four.
Well, it's bursts. I think a lot of people in executive roles will tell you, you know, it can be really intense periods, and there are periods where sort of everything's broadly under control and, you know, you're not putting in anywhere near as much time and you're doing a lot more thinking, and then you sort of burst into another thing. Mm. Well, that's how I found it anyway. Yeah.
And now your comment about regulatory environment in New South Wales. Don't let me forget that, because I've got a query about that, especially in regard to your Tomingley extension. Now, Alkane, it's been, as you said, it's been around for a long time. It's good. And the unique thing about Alkane that comes to mind first up, you've got your producing asset at Tomingley, then you've got
big time
exploration in the...
With Boda Geyser,
And your big gold porphyry... Copper gold porphyry deposits in close proximity to Cadia. So there's two areas of the business. We'll start with Tomingley, and I guess myself and Robbo did a bit of segment on it in one of the weekly news updates recently. Notorious for being under promise, overachiever, exceeding guidance regularly.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about the project.
Yeah, so it'll tap a little back into the history of Alkane. In the mid-90s, Alkane developed the Peakill gold mine, which is, Peakill's about halfway between Dubbo and Parkes in Western New South Wales, central Western New South Wales. And that was an open cut heap leach gold operation. You know, small scale as a lot of stuff was then. And it explored the tenements to the north of Peakill. And in doing so, discovered, there was some old historic workings there, discovered the pits that in time became Tomingley. And so Alkane went for approval for Tomingley in a process that sort of went from 2010 through to 2012. I had to do some iterations and got it approved at the start of 2013, and it came into production then. And we, you know, when we started it, we were going to do 360,000 ounces, you know, and we're probably at about, I don't know, we passed 500,000 ounces last year, so I don't know, we might be 550,000 ounces out of it now. And at the time, you know, gold was actually falling in Aussie, and it was falling back through 1450. And halfway through construction, some of the meetings we were having was, should we progress with this? And we thought that the geology was sound, so we did, because at our heart, we're a geological and technical team. But it felt really risky at the time, as things, these sort of things often do.
Did it feel more risky being in New South Wales compared to being in Kalgoorlie?
Not at all, no. It was just risky on cost versus, you know, gold price. But we had, you know, a view on the geology. And the reason why I tell that story is for our different pits, the first pit we did, which was only Small Wyoming 3, you know, we mined, for the pit shell that we had, we mined 33% more than the initial resource, more gold, for the same size shell. And in,
once it was reconciled at the end of the
So the inferred conversion was more than that. Now, of course, you know, geological types will understand that where it actually ends up compared to where it actually was is always a tiny bit different in dimensions and shape and all that sort of stuff. It was open cut, but you know, we thought there was X ounces there. We got 130% of X, and then we ended up with four pits there: Coloma 2, Wyoming 1, and Cloma was -8% against that whole of resource. There were some dike structures in there that we hadn't expected. Cloma 2 was nearly +30%, and then Wyoming 1 was in the teen percent. So the whole mine has ended up in its open cuts being +10% of the resource as we understood it at the start. And that's because we were conservative about that. We didn't want to be wrong. When we went underground on a mine of 90,000 ounces we thought we might be able to do. And we're pretty worried about it. For a while, we weren't going to do the underground.
As in 90,000 for the whole?
90,000 for the whole development, right? But yeah. we use second-hand fleet and a small, we're our own operator. And, you know, here we are, we're mining, I don't know, 100 and something thousand ounces through it. And, you know, that team has developed down towards Roswell and we've got another 700,000 ounces in front of us, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the main reason why we tend to over-reconcile is, you know, for your listeners that are into, you know, geostatistics, you know, we do top cuts, we do kriging, we do things, we don't try and push all the boundaries of stuff. But sometimes when you get visible gold, it's not necessarily there. That's why the geostatistics are there. But in general, for us, it's been there. And so in general, we've had portions of the ore body that run at 20 grams, 50 grams, 100 grams that have turned up but haven't been in the resource model.
So it's a very nuggety style ore body?
Not particularly. Gravity is about 30 to 40% in that ore body. It's more that the continuities are good. And so things that we haven't necessarily joined together, the drill holes have ended up being connected. You know, and the visible gold portions end up being, you know, a little higher than we expected. That's it really. But it's been good to us, and you know, we're pleased. Obviously.
Well, yeah, I suppose you haven't fell in the trap of that record is our next target.
Well, no, I mean,
because you produced 75,000 last year, and now you're still only anticipating 62 to 70 this year.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, you would know from your own experience, ore bodies seem to have a natural rate, right, of extraction of, you know, there's a certain ounces per vertical meter, but then there's a certain stope width, a certain rate you can backfill, a degree of congestion that comes from the decline design, or in a pit, you know, ramp, overtaking lanes, all that stuff, you know, everyone listening would know. And I think often you can get in a senior ore like mine, you can get into the trap of wanting more and more and more when the natural ore body can't release it. And all of us budget it, you know, I don't know, plus 85% industry performance, but we're all budging that. So 100% of industry performance is all budging in the top 15%. Yeah. So you need to be really careful that you've accommodated for things, because you know what it's like. You've got stressed men and women on the surface and underground, and you know, mistakes start to run and mistakes compound in an underground environment.
Over a year, like, you can't expect everyone to be, you might have your 100% day, but you can't expect it.
Yeah, yeah. And,
year,
and
day in, day out.
And it takes something like a slot firing. Like, invariably it will go well, but every now and again there's, you know, a fault structure that you haven't mapped, and the slot hangs up and it takes you 4 days to clear it and you're out of sequence. And do you know what I mean?
They don't clip a bloody dead on, who
knows? But you know what I mean? Yeah, all of those things. And it's, No one goes to work to be a stuff up, right? We all want to go to work and get a good job done, you know, particularly the people that we employ. Everyone's having a red hot go at it. But things don't always go to plan for a whole range of reasons. You can, a delivery, a mesh can get delivered to the wrong side. Or, you know, there's all sorts of weird stuff that just happens, you know. And but, you know, we got a really good team there. And so, yeah, we tend to over-reconcile. I know I've drifted away off topic. Sorry, mate.
That's all right. Now, those weird stuff ups have formed a great basis for the podcast content for 4 years, because that's sometimes it creates a lot of fan interest.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you're pretty low on the cost side, $1,300 an ounce last year, Aussie.
Yeah, we are, yeah. Yeah.
What are we attributing that to?
Well, I think, you know, people need to first remember we're owner-operator, right? And so that means that our equipment costs have been capitalized when people look at an AISC, right? So, you know, other people who might be using a contractor who might be getting similar rates and, you know, true unit costs, they're also reflecting back into their fee that they're charging the client, the equipment costs. So you're
getting charged a monthly jumbo fee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we don't have that. We've got all the on costs and stuff, but the other stuff's capitalized, right? And so it's not until it depreciates back that it then starts up here in our AIC. So that's one thing. So it's a true, that there's a difference of that that comes. The second thing is that, you know, that central west region, people are residential. So there's not a fly in, fly out on cost, which, you know, we would understand both in the way it impacts employees and therefore, you know, the leave and rosters, the cost of that. So that's with labour being a large cost in most mining operations, that's relevant. Third thing is we're on the grid for electricity. So the New South Wales grid is, you know, it's got its own issues. We read about that in the paper, of course. But it does mean you can get long dated power contract prices and really evaluate stuff. And in general, it's cheaper, certainly than cheaper than doing diesel gensets in the West. But, you know, it's generally cheaper than power supply that you can get here in the West. And lastly, logistics tend to be easier, you know. So the Eastern Seaboard, particularly having served a lot of coal stuff, explosives manufacturing, delivery, you know, there's major spare parts stuff in Dubbo serving Western New South Wales out through Nyngan and Cobar, stuff in Park, stuff in Orange. So, you know, moving equipment to get it rebuilt and bring it back, all those things just end up costing less, even though, you know, the underlying parts cost the same from, you know, Caterpillar, Atlas, Copco, whoever we're getting them from. So all those things just, they just add up together. And then but above all, the ore body itself is a, you know, has good continuity and a reasonably robust grade. We, you know, we have an underground cutoff grade of about 1.3 at the moment. Yeah.
And so, what's that New South Wales district like? It's probably a lot more spread out than, like, say, the Goldfields.
Well, in terms of operations, yeah. So,
but there's still a lot of the servicing, like service centres, like Dubbo with Cat.
Yeah, I mean, Dubbo's a town of nearly 50,000 people, you know.
It's a regional hub.
Yeah, massive regional hub. And, you know, so is Orange, and Orange has even got, you know, with the support of Cadia there, it's become a real tourist environment. Parks are small, 15,000. You know, I mean, I guess for people listening from WA, it's like sort of like being at Guildford in terms of infrastructure, and it looks a lot like the Swan Valley in terms of, you know, a bit higher rain fall than that. You know, it's sort of flat pasture land. I think the big thing in New South Wales is landholder density. So a lot of New South Wales is freehold land. It's only in the real western areas that you get leasehold land. So they're owned farms, and a lot of them have sort of subdivided through, you know, a parent passes away, divides it amongst three children, and then that sort of stuff. So in general, farms are becoming smaller there, or hobby farmers. You know, people have want a lifestyle change and move to a 15-acre block from out of Sydney or something. And that adds complexity because, you know, we, in developing Tommingley, you know, which is good for us, but it's not, you know, it's not a 500,000 ounces a year, right? You know, we ended up, there's seven underlying farms underneath that we bought. We actually did more trades than that because we swapped farms and other things in order to get it away. And that's due to our long presence in the region. So that underlies, a lot of what people see as complexity in New South Wales. Actually, there's just more people there.
God, you could diversify the company and get into cattle. Like, they're making
it. We do. We actually run, for Australian Strategic Materials, before we split out, we have a whole farming business
called Tungai
Pastoral, but that went with that company.
Yeah.
But they subcontract, you know, long relationship, they subcontract back to us to manage our farm. We've got, you know, a couple of thousand hectares that we run. Yeah, we run cropping and cattle and sheep. Yeah.
God, you'd be mad not to at these prices.
Yeah.
Now, I want to get back to, you mentioned permitting and the regulatory side. Now, with your Tommingley extension, what's New South Wales like with things like that? Getting extensions, like expedited?
Like many things, having something extended or, you know, a variant of it approved, you want to build a new crushing circuit or something like that, is easier than doing something completely from scratch. And that's mostly because psychologically, you know, people are used to it, right? And so if you've moved there from somewhere else, you know, it was always there, right? Whereas if you bought something and 5 years later a mine arrives, well, that's a different thing. You know, I think New South Wales has more industry conflicts than WA does because, for instance, in these regions you have, you know, profitable sheep areas, cattle areas. It may even be a small town there. There's a lot of small towns dotted around the place. You know, Tommingley, for instance, is a town of 50-odd people. And this is near that, right?
Yeah.
And so all of those things, you know, the law is set up and the regulations are set up to manage that. And particularly a lot of them came out of coal, right?
I was about to say, is it a bit stained by the
coal stigma? Yeah, so the regulatory environment is framed by coal, right? And so, and coal is, you know, closer to Sydney and in some of the different areas, Hunter Valley and et cetera, and different farmlands, at larger strip mining impact. And so that shapes the regulatory environment. It shapes the perception of it. And so without a doubt, that spills over. But the other thing to think about is, so Sydney, a town of, I don't know, a city of, I will call it 5 million, I don't really know headquarters at the moment. In most of them, like many residents of Perth, the difference in Perth is, you know, mining's in our media. Most people know someone who's in mining or even someone that's in oil and gas. In Sydney, you won't know anyone, right? And so mining is perceived, because it does have, as having an environmental impact, whether it's coal, and but just an environmental impact. And people think, well, is the benefit really worth it? Well, I'm here in Sydney. I can get whatever I need from the supermarket. I can buy my car. I can do my thing. I live my life. I don't think it's really worth it, right? Now, that's, we can argue about whether that's short-sighted or not, but that forms the voting base that drives for change in amongst the politicians, that drives for stricter regulation on environmental impacts and things like that, right? And then, but, and so we do tend to see, you know, rules and laws passed that reflect that community sentiment, as they should. We live in a democracy and that's a community sentiment. That being said, provided you get, you know, things that are pretty normal around here in all over Australia, tailings management, noise, light, dust, water, water usages, where do they go? It's very, very similar. It's just you need to deal with that increased population density and make sure that each of those people are dealt with. And that of course, shifts, I think it shifts your opening cost, but I don't think it shifts your ongoing cost.
Yeah. And it's, well, look, take coal away. Look, I know it's hopefully in the past soon, but the Hunter Valley wouldn't be the Hunter Valley if they didn't have the coal. That has built that whole industry, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And nor do I think...
They wouldn't do it just off wine.
No. And, I mean, they would be lovely country towns on wine and horses. And it's the same for Orange, right? You know, the income that's come from Cadia since the 90s into Orange has driven consumption, which has driven the capacity of people to go to restaurants and wineries, which has driven that as a sort of food and wine centre, which coexists with mining, which now attracts tourists. Rob, you sort of, you know, all those things need to live in a balance.
And the Sydney, yeah, the Sydney people don't.
Yeah, and that's not having a go on. It's just the way it is, right?
Yeah, sheltered. Now, the second bucket of our kind, the exploration.
Yeah.
Now, this is, it's very interesting too. The, like, big, something that's probably not, that's not over the west, that is more over the east, the big gold copper porphyry deposits.
Yes.
They've got Boda and Kaiser, as you're, I'm sure you're very well aware.
Yeah.
Look, tell us a bit about it. You've, look, a lot of ounces in the resource. I'll just read them on Did It. So that's, look, it's 15 million ounces gold equivalent.
Yep.
So 7.7 gold and remainder in copper.
Yeah.
First up, when you see something like this, and I'll assure you this is later down the track, if someone asks you, is it a gold mine? Is it a copper mine? Is it a copper concentrate with gold credits? Do you ever know in the early stages?
Or? Oh, I mean, you get a reasonable idea. I mean, our early metallurgical test work suggested that we could form a copper concentrate with gold credits, and the remaining pyritic tail from that could then be leached to, you know, in a traditional circuit to make gold bullion, right? So at the moment, it's about 50-50 in value, you know, at the prices, the price range that we're seeing at the moment. And I think the good thing about that is it attracts the interests of people that sort of see that structural dislocation coming in copper. And the other good side of that is it's, you know, the advantage of gold is it's very, very simple to market and move and sell, right? So it's sort of not one or the other at the moment, but I think it's attractive in both camps. I mean, Alkane, you know, it started as an exploration company in 1969 and listed in the early 80s, and it's been exploring, you know, actively in the Central West since the mid 80s, you know, and we picked up these tenement packages. Some of this ground's been gone over by the likes of Newmont and Newcrest and Rio back when it's CRA and other stuff, and we picked up different bits of this tenement over the time. So porphyry deposits, you know, this, you know, of course you've got Cadia, Northparkes is a different type. You know, this is a different type to those again. I guess people much more consider them sort of in the more active arcs, you know, and sort of the 30 million years old, you know, whereas this area is sort of 400 odd million years old. They shouldn't really exist. They should all be mashed up now by, you know, plate movement. But for whatever reason, they exist.
What is different about Boda and Kaiser to Northparkes and Cadia?
Oh, just the host rocks, for instance. You know, there's more biotite, for instance, in it. It's nothing remarkable. You know, they all, you know, North Parkes today, people talk about pencil porphyries, these, you know, thinner, higher grade stuff. Katie's got massive lower grade stuff, but then it had this amazing pipe in Ridgeway that, you know, really helped break the back of financing and, you know, propel the profit flowing out of that. What we're looking at the moment is a larger, lower grade system with some higher grade portions in it, particularly at Boda. It looks to be open cuttable at Kaiser. You could do an open cut at Boda, but maybe you'd launch a sublevel cave, right? It's really early days. You know, we want to take that through to indicated at Kaiser and Boda by the end of the year and then really try and understand it. We've got a team of, if you include the fieldies we've got, and not including drilling, you know, our own team's nearly 30 people.
What's it like converting a mass deposit like that from inferred to indicated? Have you got to pepper it with a lot more holes than you would with the vein system?
Yeah, because like it's yes and no, right? Because there's geological continuity. So if you can see the geological continuity and you can see that it joins together, this is through your drilling and your analysis, then you can say, okay, I need less drilling for the same statistical benefit because I have a geological interpretation over the top. It was all mashed up and spotty. You'd have to do a hell of a lot more drilling. But the good thing about a porphyry deposit, in general, they have greater geological continuity, so you can do a wider based drill spacing because they're more consistent. You know, people sort of say, "Oh, aren't you guys lucky to have discovered it?" I mean, yes and no. I mean, we've been drilling in and out of there for nearly a decade, and
a lot of land there too. Also,
go and reinterpret that data. I think a thing to note is, we've never shut down that geological team, right? So all through the 2000s and, all the early 2010s when people were laying off geologists, we didn't. We kept that team together. We didn't have any redundancies in the geological team, and we got them to go right back and comb through the data and reinterpret stuff and give us plans. Then as we started to free cash up out of top, then we went back into it, right? And now we have one of the larger exploration teams of any company, in New South Wales. And the majority of our free cash after that we put aside for the Tomlin Lee development goes into exploration. Because it makes companies money. If you look at just the McPhillamys transaction for us, our discovery onto that, the little amount of money we put into that, the JV and with Newmont, and this sale to Regis, we've put maybe $1 million of Alkane money into that. And, at the time, the script value of the Regis stock was 75. Yep. And you see that again and again and again here with... whether it's guys going back in like Bellevue again or the Chalice discoveries, or whatever, exploration yields success. And what we try and do is rather than looking like we're waiting for a buyer, we say, well, if no one wants to buy this, we'll develop it.
If you got the answers in there, if you got 15 million gold equivalent ounces.
Yeah, and there's a lot of work to go into that, right? But, people need to remember that, this might be a thing that's in production in a decade's time. And, who knows what the pricing of it will be there. We need to be ready for that. And there's a lot of groundwork to do. There's a lot of, ecological, environmental, supply chain groundwork to go in. Yeah.
Does your long-term strategy of an asset like this dictate your exploration spend in the early stage? Like, do you have to have a bit of a plan of like are we going to develop it? Are we looking for Newcrest to come and tap us on the shoulder to acquire it?
Well, I don't think anyone would ever want to acquire something that you're not showing a pathway to development on, right? I mean, they themselves would only come in if they think one day they could make an economic deposit out of it. And so we think the best value for Alkane shareholders is to advance it as far up the value curve as we can under our own steam, right? And then, there's a logical thinking point about that at the end of the year, right? Because we'll have an indicated thing, we'll have a concept study. Other people might be interested, other people might not be interested, right? That's okay. We're open to nearly anything. We're open to develop stuff. We're open to JV people in. We're open to do offtake stuff. So we're open to spend a bit more on it and then go and raise funding. It's sort of hard to say, really. Yeah. Until you've unlocked the potential, if that makes sense.
Now, obviously, you can't give away. You've got early stages of talking about scoping and everything. But yeah, look, you mentioned sublevel cave. If you're you're a company in your position, we're actually part to kind of develop this ourselves.
Yeah.
Compared to say Newcrest or a Newmont is that where sublevel cave becomes very advantageous for the revenue?
The key thing, of course, would be to get an open cut, right? And then because, should be pretty low strip ratios, many porphyries are, and just get a smaller plant, get the revenue moving, underground decline down, set up for sublevel. I mean, I look at what Oz has achieved with Carrapateena. You know, originally they looked at a block cave that didn't hold together economically, but a sublevel was something digestible for them. And then they put out the study that showed they were going to go to a full block cave. You know, assuming everything geotechnically holds up, that's a pretty sound approach because, you know, you imagine, you know, say our market cap circa $400 million at the moment. You know, imagine us saying, oh, we're going to launch a $3 billion, 30 million ton per annum processing in block cave. Everyone's going to go, no, you're not.
You're not going to get the order 2028.
Yeah, everyone's like, no, you're not going to do that, right? But if we say, well, we're going to do this staged approach and we'll build it like this and we'll get to there and then we'll unlock that and here's how the capital we manage and here's how we keep shareholder value growing. People could understand and see that. And but we haven't answered those questions ourselves, mate. You know?
Yeah. What's cost pressures like in New South Wales compared to Western Australia? They're very, very, very well known that cost pressures are very high in Western Australia at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, like we were talking about a little bit earlier, not quite the same. I think certainly, you know, power prices are under pressure. You know, certainly they are for domestic customers. You know, cost of steel is coming off for like your meshing and your mill walls and drills and bits and stuff. You know, not too bad, to be honest. You know, a lot of WA is driven by more and more people looking to go underground, right, with their deposits. You know, you've got even some of the lithium guys are talking about going underground at the moment. And so there's just a shortage of trained personnel, and you know, you can be enticed as an employee to go to somewhere for better money and a better roster and a better camp structure, as you should be able to, right? You know, New South Wales tends to be a little stickier for that. There's a real lifestyle trade-off. And yes, you're trading money for lifestyle, but, you know, it's worth, you know, for a mum to go home and see her kids each night and read them a story after a 12-hour shift. I mean, you'll be tired and they might only get to give them a bath and put her to bed, or a got to go home, see his wife. You know, it's worth a lot.
Right? And it cures the itch. Compared to not being there for the whole
way. Yeah, absolutely. And even the fact that, you know, you're only, you know, 45K down the road, you know, if there's a crisis and, you know, all the stuff that's happened to all of us when we've been away on mine sites and something happens to one of your kids and, you know, your wife's in, rightly so, upset and they've got to go to hospital and you go after this and, you know, many of us don't live near a family support structure, right? Mm. So, yeah, you know, that's worth a lot, right? And yeah.
If you're going to split, yeah, dissect your company into two. You got your $400 million market cap.
Yeah,
you got Tomalley, and you got your Porphyry Exploration. How much do you reckon is attributed by investors to each?
I don't know. I mean, I think if we were just Tomalley standalone at the forefront of the cash generation, I think we'd be worth even more than the market cap is at the moment. So I sort of view it at the moment as Tomalley's a touch undervalued, and the rest is free, right? I think. I think.
Spoken like a true MD.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we're doing 65,000 ounces. We got margins of at least $1,000 an ounce. It's more than most people. Even if you do old cash flow multiples on an NPV basis times by 6 or 7 or whatever you want to do, you get to the market cap, right? And I can understand why people find it difficult to put a value on Boda, right? Because if you say that that's baked into our share price, right, and someone says we call it 300 for Tomalley and 100 for Boda, you know, people think, well, how are you going to create value for us going forward on that, right?
Yeah. And with cost, and you read all the broker reports, the quarterlies, the half yearlies, everything is cost pressure, cost pressure, cost pressure.
Yeah.
And you're sitting at that, not many are sitting at that 1300 mark. So look at it. Yeah,
I mean, I think we'll end up this year at sort of, you know, our guidance was 1550 to 1800 because, you know, we didn't know. We didn't know where, when we put that guidance out, you know, where's all this movement going to end? But it seems to have broadly stabilized, so I expect to be at the bottom end of that. But that's a really good position to be in.
Yeah.
Particularly underground.
Mm, very much so.
Mm.
Now, newsflow. What's happening? What's coming up?
Well, I mean, after such a flurry of newsflow now, in before the end of March, so within the next 4 weeks, we should have drilling to the south of Boda at Boda 2 and 3. That'll come out. And then, you know, another 2 months after that, we'll have more drilling at Boda. We'll have drilling at right just north of our Roswell deposit, just off our, right near where our vent rise is going in down there. We'll be drilling into McLean's. We'll have some results out of that by the middle of the year. Middle of the year, we'll be saying, yeah, it's all systems go, and we'll start sort of giving it'll be just called almost construction news flow, but it won't really be because we'll be underground and the, you know, we're already running the plant and stuff, but we'll just call it project style news flow on that. And that's really it, because we've sort of gone through that, you know, toll gate definition process, you know, sort of thing. And now we're into sort of back into a getting it done phase again, right?
Is Tomingley, I guess, your standard gold operation, couple of years runway and proven on the way down as your decline?
It's been like that in different times. It's approved out now to 2032. So we've got a pretty clear line of sight for the next decade, yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. Yeah, because we had to get the project approvals and the debt squared away for it. Yeah, we had to design quite a bit of it.
Is most of that on the extension?
The extension, yeah. So we've got another couple of years ahead of us at the existing operation, because the three pits that we run, each of them's open at depth still, right? And, you know, different lenses pinch in and out, and it's very like the Eastern Goldfields in that sense, right? So a large part of the life that I referred to does come from down south, yeah.
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 All right, stuff, mate. Well, thanks very much for, popping the Life of Mine cherry today. It's great to finally have you on.
No worries.
Talked about you a few times with Robbo and that, so it's good to hear it from the horse's mouth. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
So hopefully thanks plenty more to come, and best of luck with the gold pours this year.
Yeah, thanks.
Let's hope that doesn't always say luck will hopefully not come into it.
Yeah, exactly.
Good on you, Nick. Thanks very much, mate.
Thanks.